Now, if you've turned on the news lately, chances are you've probably heard something about new research findings on the coronavirus. Things like how far it can travel, how long it can stay suspended in air, can be a lot to keep up with, and there isn't always a consensus among researchers about what it means and what to do with that info. So how can we start to make sense of it all, and what are some strategies to help you understand what's right, what's wrong, and what's in the gray area? Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse is a pediatric infectious disease doctor at Mayo Clinic. Dr. Rajapakse, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get into particular studies and bits of information, just for us lay people out there, how do you recommend we read, you know, that new news headline about latest research on transmission or efforts to find a cure or anything related to this disease?
So I think there's really been a flood of information that has come out about COVID-19. I think it's really important that we all understand how to tell the good and accurate information apart from some of the misinformation that has come out as well. It's really been heartwarming to see kind of the response of the scientific community in terms of studying this disease that really 3.5 months ago we didn't know anything about, and the amount of new information that has come out since then has been really heartwarming to see. I think it's really important that people are getting their news and information from validated sources that are critically evaluating some of the studies that have come out, and ensuring that these studies are done using proper scientific methods so that we're basing all of our actions and decisions on sound scientific information.
Well, I want to take a look at one example. There was a researcher at MIT who said droplets carrying coronavirus could travel as far as 27 feet. Here's a response from Dr. Anthony Fauci, part of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, to a reporter's question about that study.
This could really be terribly misleading, John. What it was looking at the distance that droplets fly by speaking, by coughing, by sneezing. So if you go way back and go, achoo, and go like that, you might get 27 feet. But so when you see somebody do that, get out of the way.
There are some people.
But
that
that's not practical.
I know people that can do that.
That is not practical, John. I'm sorry, but I was disturbed by that report because that's misleading. That means that all of a sudden the 6-foot thing doesn't work. That is a very, very robust, vigorous achoo sneeze. That's what that is. And that's not what we're talking about.
And Dr. Rajapakse, that's where it can be tricky. It's not that study itself was wrong. They had measured a thing. It's kind of what we do with it and how we interpret it on a practical level. How do we sort that out as we in the media and you in the science world try to communicate that without misleading people?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the case with things like this. So it's important to realize that there are certain situations or conditions that you can set up in a lab setting that really would not be mimicked in real life. So this also applies to some of the studies that have come out looking at how long the virus survives on certain types of surfaces, for example. So some of these studies have had widely differing estimates ranging from a few hours to a few days. And really, those studies are really dependent on the exact situations that they have set up in the lab in order to test this. So we know that things like exposure to UV light or humidity or how much virus is on the surface to begin with really affects how long it will last. And so it's really important that while these studies are very helpful in helping us kind of understand the virus better, that we take the conclusions and we apply them in a way that makes sense to real life situations and scenarios.
Well, let's talk about the distancing and how far a virus could successfully be transmitted in air. Based on what we know and then the latest research, what should people be thinking about?
So I think when it comes to transmission, there is a lot of different factors that we have to weigh in. Some of the information that we're using to understand transmission of this virus has to come from our knowledge of transmission of other similar viruses, just because this one has not been around long enough for us to be able to fully study it itself. And so based on the information we have about other similar viruses, so other viruses in the coronavirus family, including prior viruses like SARS or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus that have caused quite severe outbreaks, we still believe that the primary mode of spread of this virus is via respiratory droplets. And we see that spread is happening most commonly amongst people who are in close contact. So that is within that 6-foot distance from someone who is infected. And so while there may be certain situations, including certain types of scenarios that may happen within a hospital setting, if someone's having certain procedures done that would result in the virus being spread in different ways, such as through aerosols, which is another word people may be hearing a lot, mm-hmm. The primary mode of spread is still thought to be droplets. I think one of the tricky things about this virus that it took a bit of time for us to appreciate was the fact that people who don't have symptoms or don't have symptoms yet can still transmit it. This is quite different than the other coronaviruses that we have more experience with. For example, SARS back in 2002, people really didn't spread that virus or transmit it until they were well into their period of developing symptoms. And so for that outbreak, it was very effective to just find all the people who had symptoms and isolate them. And that was really one of the main reasons why that outbreak was controlled so quickly. So it's a different case for this virus, and we're all kind of having to learn on the go about it. And that's kind of one of the unique things that has come up that has also resulted in some of the recommendations changing around the use of masks and other protective equipment.
And yeah, what are the most recent thoughts as you're seeing on the use of masks? I know the CDC had recommended that we non-healthcare people, for example, wear cloth masks out in public. What are we accomplishing when we do that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When someone who does not have symptoms is wearing a mask, you are really doing that to prevent transmission to other people in the chance that you have the infection, but you're not showing any symptoms of it. So wearing the cloth mask in public is really to protect people around you rather than to protect yourself. They've looked at some studies looking at the cloth masks to see how well they filter the air that you're breathing in. And unfortunately, they don't perform very well for that function. But what they do well is to keep any droplets that are produced when you speak or cough or sneeze. They keep those from extending out very far beyond you and therefore can protect the people around you. So that's why recommendation is there.
We're talking to Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse, a pediatric infectious disease doctor at Mayo Clinic. She's with us to talk about some of the latest coronavirus research coming out and how we can make sense of it all, even if we're not scientists ourselves. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What studies have you seen coming out in the news? Do you feel confused comparing one headline, one study to another? How do you decide what's worth paying attention to and which ones may not be? Do you have a question for our guest about kind of the state of the art when it comes to how this disease spreads, how the treatment, the quest for treatment is going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about coronavirus research literacy and how to make sense of the changing research we're seeing in the news. Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse is with us. She's a pediatric infectious disease doctor at Mayo Clinic. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about when it comes to how we in the public should deal with this illness based on the latest research? What are some of your trusted sources you go to for information? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Rajapakse, let's talk about research now on treatments. Now, there are a couple drugs out there in the news that have been used to treat things like malaria and lupus and rheumatoid conditions. It's got a little politicized, but there's, you know, hope that they can be useful treatments, mixed results from studies, I know. What do we know about the latest research trying to see if existing drugs could help us here?
Yeah, so that's a really great question and a question that many of us healthcare providers have as well and are looking into. There are many what we would call candidate therapeutics. So there's nothing that has been proven to be helpful for treatment of COVID-19 yet, but there are many different medications that we think may be helpful. And because we don't have that proof yet, these are generally being studied in what we would call a clinical trial. So clinical trial involves enrolling patients who have the disease, in this case COVID-19, with their consent, and then testing some of the medications to see, one, whether they work, and two, what any of the downsides or side effects might be. And this is done in a very standardized and systematic way, usually in comparison to a group of patients who get a placebo or a medication that is not active, so that we can surely know whether the medication itself has had an effect or not. And so hundreds of these are in progress around the world, looking at some of the different medications that people have probably been hearing about, things like hydroxychloroquine or remdesivir or other antiviral medications, as well as some medications that work on the immune system and how it interacts with this virus, as well as something called convalescent plasma, which is taking antibody from people who have recovered from the illness and giving that to people who are sick to see if that helps them to fight it off even faster.
That's right. We talked to a Wisconsin doctor who had COVID-19 is now donating his own plasma for research. I want to bring our callers in now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Rusk County. Mike, hello.
Hi. I'm hoping that the guests can help reinforce or clarify some. A lot of the people on social media and in other alternative media are pushing the whole idea of the mortality rate, and that while it's only 98.5% of the people, or 1.5% or less, that are dying, therefore it's really pretty good risk or pretty good odds. But I would hope that the guest would clarify that it's not really the mortality. The mortality rate is driven by access to health care and the ability to get modern medicine and so forth, and that the mortality rate would jump up substantially if our hospitals get overwhelmed and so forth. Could you speak to that and help people understand to get stuck on this mortality rate?
Mike, thanks for the call, Dr. Rajapakse. So the impact of the mortality rate, but also how many people are ending up in the hospital because of this, those are two separate but related reasons for why we worry about this thing.
Yeah, so that's a really great question, and I agree. There's been kind of a lot of misinformation or misperception of the information that is out there. I think you make a great point that the mortality rate from this is not really just one number. We know that there are certain groups that are at higher risk of dying, and so we know older adults and people who have underlying health problems, the mortality rate for them is certainly much higher than it is for younger people. And we also know that your mortality rate is also related, as was mentioned, to your access to health care. So in a situation where we do an excellent job of flattening the curve, which we are seeing in some areas of the Midwest now, our hospitals are then able to cope with the number of patients who become ill and have the resources to use a ventilator if a patient needs one or use other life-sustaining treatments. And in that scenario, we can hopefully keep the mortality rate relatively low. But if we get into a situation where we have a large surge in cases, that's a situation where you see the mortality rate increase because our healthcare system just doesn't have the resources to provide all of the life-saving equipment or personnel that many, many sick people would need all at once. And so in that situation, here or in parts of the world where they just don't have access to ICU-level care, we will see that the mortality rate is higher than what is being quoted. I think the numbers that are also being quoted currently are based on partial information just related to how much testing we've been able to do as well. And so I do expect to see those numbers change as we go through this pandemic as well.
We just have a few moments left. I want to pass on a question from a caller, Lisa, who says she's a healthcare worker and she wonders what precautions she should take to to protect her young daughter and others, given that she might be exposed at a healthcare facility. In our last minute, can you talk about that, Dr. Rajapakse?
Yeah, so this is certainly a question that I empathize with as well. I think everyone in healthcare is being very brave and showing up to work to take care of these patients that really need us while also being concerned about taking this home to our own families at home. So I think from a healthcare provider perspective, adhering to all of the recommendations that your hospital has in terms of wearing the appropriate personal protective equipment, eye protection, masks, gowns, gloves, if you're interacting with patients who have or are suspected to have COVID-19, And then we've been recommending if people are wearing scrubs, you can change into different clothing at work instead of taking them home, and making sure that anything you're wearing at work goes into the laundry straight away. I cannot overemphasize the importance of hand washing as well. Hand washing as soon as you leave your work area, as soon as you get home, will really help protect your loved ones at home as well.
Dr. Rajapakse, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we can talk to you again in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse, pediatric infectious disease doctor at Mayo Clinic. She was with us today to break down what we need to know about some of the new and changing research on the novel coronavirus and tips for how we can make sense of that research on the coronavirus in the future.